Hello, I'm Doug, and welcome to the Crew of Japan podcast, a weekly podcast where we take you on audio journeys through Japanese culture.
This time on Crew of Japan podcast.
Shikoku is the fourth largest island in the Japanese archipelago, and for the most part, it's probably the least tourist-traveled island of the Big Four. However, embedded deep in the fabric of daily life is the legacy and impact of Japanese monk and founder of the Shingon sect of Japanese Buddhism, Kobudaishi, who's also known as Kukai. In the 9th century, legend has it that Kobudaishi walked around the island of Shikoku in search of enlightenment. Ever since, pilgrims, also known in Japanese as Henro, have followed in his footsteps, stopping at the 88 official temples scattered across the four prefectures of Shikoku. In fact, I personally embarked on this pilgrimage 12 years ago with my friend Chris during our time on the JET program. However, due to time constraints, we took a less conservative approach and hitchhiked as opposed to walked. But as you'll find out soon enough, the mode of travel isn't necessarily as important as the journey itself. Today, the crew sits down with Todd Wassell, author of Walking in Circles, a travel memoir about his second go at the 88 temple pilgrimage of Shikoku. Todd shares some of his tales and insight into his time in Shikoku, including how long the pilgrimage actually is.
So it's about 750 miles or 1,200 kilometers. And so, you know, it's not something that you undertake in just a day or two. It typically takes anywhere from 30 to 60 days, with the average about 45 days or so if you're walking it.
Some important things to consider with weather.
You know, we were walking and somebody, you know, drove by and was like, "Typhoon coming, what are you doing?" You know, and I was with a Japanese guy and he didn't know at the time. And we just ran into a tool shed and waited for like, you know, 8 hours for it to pass.
How there really is no right way to do the pilgrimage.
You can get too serious about this pilgrimage, right? It's like some people like, oh, you know, I'm going to walk it as fast as I possibly can, or I'm going to do it the hardest way I possibly can. And I'm only going to do nojuku, which is sleeping outside. And everybody else who takes buses or taxis, they're, you know, they're not real pilgrims or things like that. You know, there definitely are that subsect of people that think that way. But the nice thing about Shikoku is that it accommodates anybody. There's no set way of doing it.
How osettai is a big part of Shikoku culture.
There's a practice on Shikoku called osettai, which is charitable givings, right? So everybody is, not everybody, but lots of people are trying to give you things to participate or help you along your journey. And the osame fuda come into play there, because if you get osettai, the rule is you have to accept whatever they give you. And you're supposed to give back the osame fuda as an exchange.
Other things to do in Shikoku.
And then there's this other town just south of Tokushima City. It's a zero waste village. So everything in the village is recycled or reused. And so it's just a super cool place to go visit. And they got a brewery there.
And so much more. Doing this interview made me want to get right back out there on the trail and follow the paths carved out by fellow Henro over the last 1,000 years. It's definitely one of the most amazing experiences of my life, and Todd helps give a great foundational understanding of what this pilgrimage entails and what to expect. So let's put on our Henro gear, grab our walking staff, and get back out there on the pilgrimage trail. All right, and today we have with us the author of Walking in Circles, Todd Wassell. Hey, Todd, how you doing?
Good, how you doing? Great to be here.
Glad to have you, and I'm super excited. This is a topic that I hold near and dear to my heart, and that topic is Shikoku, specifically the 88 Temple Pilgrimage, something I did while I was on JET years back, 12 years, I lose count at this point. Before we get too much into that, I wanted to ask you a question that we ask all of our guests. We are a New Orleans-based podcast responsible by Japan Society of New Orleans. And one thing we ask our guests is, have you ever been to New Orleans? Do you have a connection to New Orleans? And if you do, what's that connection? And if you don't, what is the first thing you think of when you hear New Orleans?
So, tough question starting from the beginning, I guess, because I haven't lived in the U.S. for 22 years now. I left in 1999. And so I think I've seen more of the world than I've seen of the U.S. at this point. But so I've never been to New Orleans. But as I thought back about this, you know, one of my best friends on the JET program, I was in Shigaken, and his name's Chris. He was from New Orleans, and he was a film buff and a student of film and cinematography, and is now actually teaching as a professor.
Okay.
Flash forward 22 years, one of my other good friends here in Laos, where I'm based, his name's Sean. He's the head of the Lom Prabang Film Festival, also from New Orleans, and also a big film person. So I guess when I think of New Orleans, beyond Mardi Gras and drinking and beads, it's really just as an artistic city full of cinema buffs.
You're right. And it's actually in the last decade or so, it's been a lot of films, they would call it Hollywood South. A lot of it has, due to various reasons, has kind of shifted somewhat to Atlanta and Georgia. But it was a huge place for filming movies down here with tax breaks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So there was a very big film industry down here. So that's a spot on assessment right there.
The only two people I know. So, you know, it's...
And it's funny you say that. Nigel, and he's mentioned this in other podcasts too, our other co-host, he's actually a film studies major that graduated from a university here in New Orleans. So there you go. Another film connection for you. All right. So our next question that we have usually after that is, what is your Japan journey? So what actually got you interested in Japan from the get-go? And then what inevitably brought you to Japan?
Okay. So I guess for me, it started with a bit of a Buddhism interest and then a karate interest. So elementary school, all throughout high school, doing karate. But Japan was always in the background, not really that big of an interest. Then in college, you know, I tried to learn Spanish and failed miserably and thought, I still want to learn another language. So I switched to Japanese and somehow it clicked. So that was kind of my first introduction. You know, I needed a language that started you at zero base knowledge of anything. You know, here is an alphabet, here, you know. And that, just from there, the interest in karate and Buddhism just grew. And then I went on a study abroad. I studied at Kansai Gaidai University in Osaka.
Okay.
And that was actually my first time out of the US in 98. And I just loved it. I just fell in love with the country, fell in love with the language. I mean, we'll get to it later. Also, you know, started the Shikoku pilgrimage during that time as well. And, you know, when you go to that first country that's, you know, your first experience outside of the US, you know, it's usually the place that you kind of fall in love with the most. And so immediately after graduating from college, I went on the JET program in 99 and then stayed there for about 5 years. Flash forward, I left 5 years later thinking I wasn't going to go back. I think we all have some kind of story of frustrations in our career life in Japan at some point where you go, I can't get anywhere else. So I left thinking I'm never... go do another job, another type of work. And I found myself in a remote island called Timor-Leste, or East Timor, where I ended up meeting my wife, who's Japanese. And so now,
thankfully,
I didn't kind of give up on Japan. And now, you know, we live back and forth. So I'm there quite often.
Well, that's great. That's great. Yeah. And I kind of have a lot of parallels there with you. The whole JET program, I studied abroad too, 1 year, and then came back home. And then, like you said, kind of had that, you fall in love with that. It's just, it was my first time out of the country, living on my own, all that stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. So it kind of, I equated it to a new life and a new, like, kind of coming out of my own shell. Yeah. So it holds a special place in my heart and obviously led me back on JET and, you know, go back now and every once in a while with my wife as well to visit her family. So it's nice to have that, you know, those type of connections. So on JET, is that when you decided to do the Shikoku 88 Temple pilgrimage?
No, actually I did it while I was a university student.
Oh, okay.
I went to a school here in upstate New York called Colgate University. Mm-hmm. And in the Japanese studies program, I mean, long story, but we were supposed to go abroad on a study abroad that was sponsored by the university or arranged by the university. And part of that program was you'd study for your semester and then you had to go walk Shikoku. That was just that was the program, right? And so this school has this long history of sending students to walk around Shikoku and get a course credit for it, as long as they wrote something on it. And so one thing or another, it was the kind of dwindling interests in Japan back in the, you know, the late 90s, and we only had two people that wanted to go abroad, so we organized it ourselves to go. And the other person who went with me didn't want to walk, so I just went by myself. So I just went with this idea of, I want to go have an adventure. You know, this kind of coming out of yourself, go do something big, something that you'd never done before. And so, unlimited funds, which meant walking was the way it was going to go. So the summer, just after I finished my semester there, right around now, hottest time of the year, in the middle of the rainy season, I set off and started walking with absolutely no idea what I was getting myself into.
So did you have a chance to read up on it or anything before you decided to, or like, you knew a little bit about it, but did you have a really big idea of what you were getting yourself into?
I was able to talk to people who had done it, but back then there were no resources in English, really. I mean, I think there was one or two books that had been written. Oliver Statler's Pilgrimage was one of them, which is kind of like a historical based book, but not really a lot of practical information on walking around. So the only maps available at that time were all in Japanese. So I was basically just, and you know, reading Japanese was not a great forte of mine at the time.
Yeah.
I was kind of walking in really blind to the whole thing, basically with a backpack and a map, and not much more prepared than that.
That's incredible. That's so for our listeners who may not be familiar, how would you best describe what the Shikoku 88 Temple Pilgrimage is?
So it's a circular pilgrimage. It's been going on, I mean, depends on how you account for it, but about 1,000 years in its modern form, let's say in the past 400 years. But a pilgrim or somebody who visits Shikoku, a Hendro, visits 88 temples that are circled around the island of Shikoku, which is Japan's fourth largest island. And they're essentially walking in the footsteps of a Buddhist saint named Kobodaishi, or Kukai, which is his Buddhist name. Kobodaishi means great teacher, so he's also the one who created the Hiragana script and founded Shingon Buddhism. And so for 1,000 years, people have been trying to trace his footsteps as he walked around Shikoku to gain enlightenment, of which it's reported that he did at a very specific temple there. And over the years, just customs and ways have built up. So now people used to walk it. Now they take all different traveling methods. We can talk about that as we go forward. But the main kind of purpose of it is, or the way of doing it hasn't changed. You visit temples one by one in a string, and you start at one point and you complete the circle and come back to the end.
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge because you encounter a lot of different things along the way. And when I say things, because it really is, you meet a lot of people, you meet a lot of places, terrain, just a lot of everything. Even emotionally, you're hit with a bunch of different feelings along the way. So it's such a, like I said, it's one of those moments or things in my life that I found is a really fun, because I completed it as well, like I said, while I was on JET, and it was an accomplishment. And I know, and I didn't even walk the whole thing. I hitchhiked and trained and biked and rented a car for one segment. So again, we can talk about all this stuff later, but yeah.
Maybe to add for the listeners, it's, I guess one thing I forgot is the length of it as well. So it's about 750 miles or 1,200 kilometers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's not something that you undertake in just a day or two. It typically takes anywhere from 30 to 60 days with the average about 45 days or so if you're walking it. And yeah, I mean, it's just this place where, yeah, I think everybody who comes back from Shikoku comes back changed in a way, and also never able to really forget their time there. There's a term called Shikoku-byo, which means kind of the Shikoku disease, where you just can't stop thinking about that time of freedom that you had. You know, like you said, you're just removed from your everyday life and you're put into all these other things that happen, right?
Yeah.
New people, new experiences, new terrain. You walk on everything from asphalt roads through cities to small little paths through, you know, dwindling villages to mountain peaks, centuries old temples. I mean, it's just, you know, it's great.
Have you ever watched So Lost, the old TV show? It's like that. You got to go back to the island. You got to go back. It's like that. When you're trying to get out of there, when you're doing it, you're like, oh my God, I'm so tired of this rain. My shoes and my feet are killing me. But then once you get done, you're like, man, I really want to get back over there. So this pilgrimage was traditionally done as a religious pilgrimage, still to this day, traditionally done as a religious pilgrimage. But I feel like many people find their own reasons to go on this journey. You know, I've heard people say that when you complete the pilgrimage, a wish that you hold dear to your heart will come true. You know, and there's another one. It was like, if you walk the path backwards, I think if you do a full, it was gyakumari, like go around backwards. You are like, sin is forgiven. This like big sin that you've done is like, you know, atoned or something like that. But let's talk about your goal. You mentioned you had interest in Buddhism. So for you, was it a religious pilgrimage, or did you have a different goal in mind when you decided to go on this, outside of just doing it as part of a school, the first time around as a school credit?
Yeah. Yeah, I think the first time around for me, I mean, you're young, you know, I was early 20s. I'd never been, like you said, outside. I felt like I hadn't done anything big on my own. I mean, some people might think just going to Japan by yourself is something big, but I don't know. There's like this adventuresomeness to it, right? This romanticism of a big pilgrimage, a big walk, a big hike that you're doing all by yourself. you know, maybe the Appalachian Trail is something similar for people in the US, right? It's just like this goal to do on your own. And so for me, it was that. It's like, you know, what am I made of? How do I become stronger in life? How do I become an adult? I thought a lot about that. And it actually goes back to, you know, in history in Japan with Shikoku is that a lot of people would go on it on kind of rites of adulthood. So you wouldn't be able to pass into the next stage of life until you did that. Or you wouldn't be able to get married until you did it and you knew yourself a bit better. So for me, there's that kind of introspective look of who am I? What can I do? How strong am I? How do I get stronger? And then there's the religious side of it, which was, just my interest in Buddhism. You know, I'd be lying if I said you're not looking for a little bit of enlightenment as well, right? You know, you're kind of on this Buddhist pilgrimage trying to whittle away all the things that kind of bug you in your mind and change who you are a bit. So
you have a lot of time to think about things. Let's just put it that way.
And it's amazing the mind's ability to distract, you know. So you go through thinking, I'm gonna figure something out, and then, you know, by day 20 you've thought about everything else except for the thing that you were supposed to be thinking about.
So the second time around, you when you went back, and this is what your book is based on, correct? The second time around, what was the reason, without giving, obviously we want to give people a reason to read your book, but like, what was the reason that you decided to do it again outside of Shikoku-byo?
Yeah, well, that's never going to go away.
Right.
Shikoku-byo gets worse each time you do it. You know, I felt like there was something left unfinished, I guess, the first time I walked. So the first time I walked the whole way. I took one car. So one car picked me up and it bugged me maybe for like 10 kilometers. And then it was at a moment of weakness. And then I walked the rest of the way. And you walk 750 miles and 7 miles of it was in a car and it bugs you. So I walked all the way back to the place where I got the car and then continued walking until I finished it so that I could say, okay, I've walked the whole thing.
There you go.
But even after that, it still bugged me that I was weak enough that I broke down and I took a car. So there was a little bit of that. I wanted to go back and prove I could do the whole thing walking. Spoiler alert for the book is it didn't quite turn out the way I thought it would. And then two, I was at a crossroads in life. So I had just left Japan. I think this is in 2004. And I went to grad school to start a new profession. So this is what I do now. I work in international development and international aid. And I just felt lost. I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. I felt like I had just taken out all these student loans. And I was racking them up, and I still didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I thought I would figure out what I wanted to be when I grew up living in Japan. And so I guess you could call it a quarter-life crisis or just not satisfied with where I was. And so I went back to try to figure it out. And this time saying, okay, I'm going to figure out what I want to do in life. I didn't realize that I was asking the wrong question. Kind of figure that out along the way. I also knew in the back of my head that I wanted to write something about Shikoku. I didn't know what it was going to be. And so on that trip in particular, not only was I thinking about myself and walking it, but I was taking notes and journaling every day and taking more pictures. So I went there with the idea that I would eventually write something about Shikoku. Now, what the book ended up becoming is a little bit different than maybe what I intended in the beginning.
That's awesome. Yeah. When I went there, and it's funny you brought up that you walked the entire thing except for that 10 kilometer stretch. When my friend and I, Chris, he was another jet, but from Fukuoka, we were walking, doing hybrid of everything. And there were these two girls from California we bumped into at one of the temples. They were walking and it was just really bad weather. And it was just really, and we were like, hey, we got a cab. Do you want to ride with us to the next one? And they're like, yeah. And so we like kind of like, with the devil like on their shoulder, like, come on, get in the car, don't walk the whole thing. So I wonder if they feel the same way. Like they're like, oh man, we did the whole thing on our feet, except for that one when those that asshole American and that idiot Brit person just, you know, tempted us with a taxi ride.
Well, but you do what you have to. I mean,
yeah.
You know, exactly. I can remember walking numerous places in the second time and people coming up to me and saying, can I give you a ride? And me saying no. And them looking at me like I was crazy. Like I was crazy, right? You know, why would you not want to ride up this mountain?
Yeah.
And every time it hurts you and it's painful and you just kind of steel yourself to the, you know, it's okay, no thanks. But then you have that great Oji-san, you know, that old guy that just is like, okay, you don't need a ride, disappears, comes back later with just like a few beers and hands them to you instead.
Oh, and says, okay. Yeah.
You know, just that kind of friendliness is great.
That's so wonderful. So wonderful. And you mentioned journaling too. I know, like, so when you were journaling and you, because you had the idea of having the book, but like I journaled for a portion of mine, like the first few days, and then I got lazy and just it tapered off. Like, you know, some people, I just can't commit to things sometimes. But I did commit to, this is right when Facebook Mobile was starting to become available on flip phones in Japan, mm-hmm. back in 2010, right before I got an iPhone. So I did make Facebook updates every time Chris and I got picked up by a hitchhiker, or not hitchhiker, but like we got picked up, or we arrived at a temple or something happened or whatever. So while I didn't have a full journal entry for like days and days and days of information outside the first few days, I did have those like micro journal entries on Facebook where it was like me commenting or making a status that also had a really cool thing of like going back and reading other people's reactions to it, and kind of reliving it. Cause I think it was last year during the pandemic, I was super like popped up on my Facebook memories feed. And I was like, yeah. Oh man, I was feeling really nostalgic, like trapped, like, yeah. Oh man, this pandemic's never going to end. Started going through it. And then I was like, oh man, I need to go back and like compile this so that we don't have to wait for a memory to pop on Facebook. But when you mentioned the journaling thing, that brought it back to my mind, how cool it was to have that, to, you know, 10 years later, to go back and reread my chicken scratch handwriting to try to decipher what the heck was going on and relive it yourself.
When I was writing the book, it's basically like reliving the whole thing, right?
Yeah.
You know, and you're going back and you're thinking through and trying to organize your thoughts. And then you start to see a pattern that you didn't see before and a change. And
yeah.
I don't know. You know, when I did it both times, I made the decision not to bring any technology with me except for a camera.
That's
and
smart.
And the second time, a voice recorder. So I had no phone. I had, you know, for those people who like Japan and are a bit nostalgic, I had the little public telephone cards, you know.
Oh, yeah. Little green box on the side of the road.
Yeah. So, and I had a Japanese map. So there was no figuring out when I was lost where I was or calling people or doing any of that. And it was just, I had a notebook, I had a piece of paper, and I had my journal. And then beyond that, you were reliant on everybody that you met every day to give you information.
Yeah.
The first time I remember, we got hit by a typhoon that we didn't know was coming.
Ooh.
And we had to basically ride out the typhoon in a tool shed on, what was it? Ashizuri Misaki. So the western part, western cape of Shikoku.
Is it in Kochi, right?
Yeah, Kochi.
Yeah.
And just suddenly, you know, we were walking and somebody, you know, drove by and was like, typhoon coming, what are you doing? You know, and I was with a Japanese guy and he didn't know at the time. And we just ran into a tool shed and waited for like, you know, 8 hours for it to pass.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. That's crazy. Since you didn't bring technology with you, like what kind of preparations did you make before embarking on your journey? Like what was some essential gear you did bring? And then what was some gear that you bought when you arrived at like Temple One, Ryozenji?
So, I mean, I knew I was going to walk the whole way. So the first time I went, I was overly ambitious or thinking that I needed a tent. So I had this huge tent that was packed in my bag and I was going to bring it with me. And I soon found out that that was just not necessary. And I shipped it back to where I was staying. And the reason for it is that on Shikoku, there's all sorts of places you can just find some, you know, a roof or a beach hut or a bus station or somewhere all along the route. And now there's more Hendro huts that have popped up.
Yeah.
Where you can kind of stay there. You have to be careful because there's some prohibitions on people, you know, the local townspeople don't always want a bunch of strange people sleeping in their train station.
Squatting.
I mean, it turns out that while a lot of us have good intentions and religious intentions going to Shikoku, it does attract a cross-section of Japanese society, and not all are as respectful as others. So there's all sorts of issues with pilgrims, you know, who are on religious time frames or their own time frames, clashing with people who live there full time and see this influx. So it's an interesting dynamic that goes back and forth. But for me, I mean, I was super minimalistic. I tried to keep it as small as possible. So I had a small backpack, I think like 4 pairs of socks. We'll get really personal in here. 2 pairs of underwear, 1 to sleep in and 1 to walk in. 2 t-shirts, 1 to sleep in, 1 to walk in. And so every day I basically walked in 1 set of gear. And then at night I would wash it in a sink or something, or running water, hang it up to dry, sleep in something else, and then put that back on. The socks I would switch out every day. So those were kind of the basic, and a sleeping pad, you know, that kind of stuff. You know, really, really just what do you need? What's the most basic thing you need? And I was in the summertime, so I didn't need a lot of heavy clothes.
Yeah.
I brought a tent to keep away the mosquitoes, not a tent, but a mesh net to keep away from the mosquitoes. And then at Rosenji, the first temple, there's a pilgrimage tour store where you buy all the kind of regalia. So I went with the classic conical straw hat that you kind of think of in old time Asia. And I love that thing. That like the best part of gear that I had. It keeps off the sun. It kept off the rain. I bought a white shirt that kind of has a, you know, a message on the back that marks you as a pilgrim. Mm-hmm. I was wearing white pants as well. And then you have a staff that represents Kobo Daishi, the person that you're walking with, the founder. And then most people will get a stamp book that at each temple you collect a calligraphy and a stamp to say you've been there. The first time I did it, I used a stamp book. And the second time I did it, I actually had a kakejiku, which is a hanging scroll.
Oh,
so,
okay.
I went through the trouble of, you've got this big thing that you unravel every time at each temple. It's got a little square to write it. And then you got to roll it back up and put it into a case and keep. And all the while, you know, you're walking in the rain, you're trying to keep it from getting soaked.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all these things that you just really basic things about, you know, your day or your life is all about walking every day, sun, rain, food, water, shelter, and kind of companionship, right? So everything in your life just gets boiled down to these such base issues that you don't, you know, that you kind of don't even notice in your everyday life. Because you're filled with so much stuff in, you know, modern life that you forget what it's like to worry about having some shelter, or when am I going to get my next bit of food, or, you know, how much water do I have in my backpack?
Yeah, that hat. I don't know what it was. When we first got myself and Chris got our hats, it was really windy. And it kept like blowing off our head and like choking us with the strap, like on our
neck. Yeah, yeah.
And so I don't know what happened to him. I know we had him, and then I'm not sure if one like blew away or something. I can't remember what exactly happened to it.
Yeah, what I did for mine is I mean, they're uncomfortable. I mean, it's just like, yeah. It's reed. It's like on top of your head. So I would wear a Japanese kind of bandana on the bottom to cushion it. And then you tie it, which gets really annoying because then you have to untie it every time you want to take it off.
Yeah.
So I put one of those kind of spring-loaded clips, right? Mm-hmm. At the bottom, so I could like open and close it really easily. So it was a mix between traditional pilgrimage stuff and modern kind of camping gear. And each person seems to figure out how they want to do it. There's nobody will lay into you for not wearing all the pilgrimage stuff.
No.
You know, if you're walking and you've got a staff, the staff is probably, I say, the most important part that kind of marks you out as a pilgrim for most people in Shikoku. Hats and what you're wearing seems to vary quite a bit.
Yeah. I think myself and Chris both resorted to the vest, yep. And we just wore it over our t-shirt, and we had a little satchel, like the little bag they can get.
Yeah, well, yeah.
But we didn't get the staff, and ooh. I didn't realize the importance of like having it until well later. Like apparently someone told me that was like what, you know, that staff is it basically is the embodiment of like Kobo Daishi and like walking with you, and also served apparently back in the day. It's a gravestone if you perished along the way.
Right, yeah.
That was
yeah.
the marker for where you landed.
so. Yeah, there's all sorts of stories. You're supposed to wear all white,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Because the white signifies death in Japan. So, there is, you know, some people say, well, if you die, then you're already prepared, you know, to be buried and things like that. I think you think about it a little bit more metaphorically, though. You know, when you go to Japan, when you go to Shikoku, you're basically dead to the world, right? So you're kind of dressing in these outfits that mark you as separate from the normal everyday life in Japan. The fact that you're walking with this stick that represents a dead Buddhist saint kind of goes back to the origin story where people on the island believe that you could actually, like you yourself could be Kobo Daishi. Because there's all these stories of meeting him on the route. So it's you enter into this kind of what's called a liminal state of you're not in society anymore. You're walking this kind of sacred path, but you have to walk through regular society. So you're kind of marked as separate, and then the locals treat you accordingly, right? So the staff has these kind of funny little quirks to it too if you're a walker. So you're supposed to treat it, wash it off at each temple as well. Keep Kobo Daishi's feet clean, I guess. But then there's this other thing where when you walk across bridges, you're not supposed to bang it on the bridge. You're supposed to hold it up. And that goes back to the myth that Kobudaishi sleeps under bridges. And so you don't want to disturb him as you're walking across.
Gotcha. Yeah, I didn't know that part. I didn't know about the bridges. I knew that there was like the washing of the staff when you know, just to clean it off for you under the temples and stuff like that. But I didn't know about the bridge one. Yeah, it's just there's so many stories you find out or hear from people. And it's all like, you know, like word of mouth or like oral tradition passed along. And it's really cool that you hear from other Henro as you're walking through the whole trail. So speaking of walking, back when, like I had mentioned this a few times already, but my friend Chris and I took the hybrid approach. We planned on hitchhiking the entire thing, which didn't happen. A few times we did walk between temples if they weren't very far apart, you know, a few kilometers or whatever didn't stop us from walking. But the plan was to hitchhike as much as we could. Some spots were just in the middle of nowhere. There's no major traffic or streets going through. You know, not everyone's going to stop to pick up two foreign guys staying on the side of the road. So we ended up doing other means of transportation to get where we need to go. But for your pilgrimage, like you mentioned, you walked for the most part the entire thing. For the first one, and with the exception of that 10 kilometer stretch, and then
I went back.
Yeah, you went back though. You retrace, you know, basically redid it for the second one. And I apologize because I maybe you don't want to touch on this because you want people to find out by reading the book. Were you tempted along the way to? Did you walk the entire thing? I guess is what I'm trying to get at without having you to actually answer that and spoil anything.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I walked the whole thing, there'd be no spoiler to say. So yeah, the intention on the book or the intention on the second walk was to walk. And I had it fixated in my mind that I was going to walk because I was trying to make up for some past perceived inabilities. But, you know, when you walk the second time, you're older than you were when you walked the first time.
Oh, yeah.
Things don't go quite as well when you're a little bit older and you're walking that long. Even, you know, I guess what I'd say without giving away too much from the book is that I came to a point on the pilgrimage where I had to make a decision. And part of the book is about that, right? So what do you know, in a Buddhist sense, I guess, being too fixated on one particular thing that you're not being flexible, being too attached. And then what does it mean to unattach yourself and think of other solutions? And so the book is, you know, that moment and thinking through that is reflective of a change that happened to me, and then also a difference of how you look at how other people are doing the pilgrimage as well.
Yeah.
One thing I think I like is you can get too serious about this pilgrimage, right? It's like some people like, oh, you know, I'm gonna walk it as fast as I possibly can, or I'm gonna do it the hardest way I possibly can, and I'm only gonna do nojuku, which is sleeping outside, and everybody else who takes buses or taxis, they're not real pilgrims or things like that. You know, there definitely are that subsect of people that think that way. But the nice thing about Shikoku is that it accommodates anybody. There's no set way of doing it.
Yeah.
You know, the temples are where they are. And yeah, there's a religious connotation to each temple, right? Each temple is a Buddhist temple and it has its own way of thinking about it. But the pilgrimage itself, the act of going from one temple to another, is left up to the pilgrim or the henro. You know, in some ways you have bus pilgrims that go all the way around, and they're typically older people that don't have a lot of time and can't walk. You have people that bicycle and cycle the whole way. You have people that do a mix of hitchhiking, cycling, taking the trains where they're available. You know, for me, I think that's just that flexibility to do it any way you want that fits your lifestyle is just one of the things that adds to it. Not everybody is as adventuresome or as able to do things the same way as other people. So it opens up a whole new, you know, it just widens the group of people that can go. And on Shikoku, you know, who knows what you're gonna learn and what you're gonna find, but you're gonna find what you need to find at that given time. So if you're pushing yourself too hard, things are gonna break and you're gonna change. If you're going too easy, probably you're gonna get a little bit bored or restless and you're gonna push yourself a little bit farther. I think no matter what, sustaining anything at a minimum of 2 weeks, which is what a bus trip might take, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or 10 days, is not easy for anybody. You know, you're going to be uncomfortable at some point over a certain period of time, and you'll gradually grow and learn something.
Yeah, and you like you said, like there's like between different ways, the bus, I feel like I saw those a lot, like the bus tours. And because when we traveled, it was during Haruyasumi, it's like spring break, and Golden Week. So like kind of two peak travel times for people who have time off from work. So I feel like we saw those when I did it everywhere. Like there was like loading, like you try to, you you're walking up to a temple and you're like, oh crap, there's 50 people just got off this bus. It's going to take an hour to get through, like to do everything here. Or you see a bus pulling up, you try to rush in there and get ahead of them. So yeah, that was one of the big ways of doing it. But hitchhiking, we met a lot of people that some were driving, some were just like, I think you briefly mentioned this earlier, doing a segment of the pilgrimage for that trip, because they're tackling it, you know, piece by piece as opposed to one giant trip, because it isn't necessarily something that can be done all at once by everybody. You have to have that 30 to 40, 60 days in your life available where you don't have responsibilities for work or family or whatever to get away to do that. And it's hard to pull away for that long of a time. But going back to when you arrive at those temples, do you remember the routine you had to follow when you were to arrive at I'm sure you had to do it 88 times at least, right? So what would a henro, a pilgrim, expect when arriving at their first temple? Like, what are the steps that they would have to follow?
I mean, it's funny. I remember so much about it. It's been a while since I've walked some of those paths, and I remember rocks and signs very specifically. When you walk slowly, you tend to pick everything up. So yeah, when you arrive, the first thing you usually do is you bow at the gate, right? You're entering kind of sacred space. So you bow and you kind of request permission. You step over the boundary of the main gate, which is usually a little lip up, with the idea that that boundary prevents evil spirits and evil things from entering. From there, you go to kind of the purification fountain. So that's a water fountain where you wash your hands and your mouth in a prescribed way, and then a little bit of your staff. From there, you go to one of two main shrines that are inside of each temple. So the first one is the Hondo, and that's the enshrined image of the Buddha for that particular temple. And so every temple typically has a different Buddha enshrined. So there's thousands of different Buddhas, right, in the Mahayana tradition, which is different than the Theravada tradition, where there's just the Shakyamuni Buddha. So you go to, first you light some incense, you go to the shrine, and you'll offer a slip called the Osame Fuda, which is basically a prayer slip that asks for good health and these kind of standard prayers. You'll write your name on it. And in the past, people used to take these slips to announce that they were at the temple. So if you go to old temples in Japan, you'll see these pasted slips that are on the columns. And that's basically graffiti of people coming to visit the temple and marking that they were there. So now with, you know, thousands of people coming through a temple in a given week, there's these slips, you put them into the offering box. These will then get burned later as your prayers go up. And you throw a little bit of money into the offering box, ring a bell, and then you offer your prayers that you want at the temple. You'll also then chant the Hanya Shingyo, which is the Heart Sutra, which is the kind of encapsulated heart of Mahayana tradition of kind of what it means to let go of non-attachment, non-self, things like that. Then you'll do it all again at the Daishido, which is the shrine or the hall particularly dedicated to Kobo Daishi. After that, you'll go to the temple office and you'll present your book or your scroll. And you'll ask them to do a calligraphy. So it's done right in front of you with a temple stamp. And you'll receive, on top of that, a temple slip that shows a picture of the Buddha for that temple, and then the name and the number on that slip. And so you do this at every temple. So eventually you come to having a book that has 88 slips in it. There's also 20 bekaku, which are like additional temples that you can also do to make it 108. 88 and 108 are really significant numbers in Buddhist philosophy, where you have 88 sins. It could be 108 sins, that's why it's gone up to 108. And the idea is that at each temple that you walk around, you're dismissing one of those sins that are preventing you from gaining enlightenment. And so a lot of people say that once you have a completed book, you're buried with it, and then you get kind of a one-way ticket to the Pure Land, which is a kind of Mahayana thought of like a heaven that is basically a representation of enlightenment. And you have to pay for each of these. So at least at the time when I walked it, I think it was like 300 yen for a standard.
Yeah, I think it was three or five. I can't remember.
And then on the Kakejiku, for me, the scroll, it was like 500 or 600. Maybe so it got more expensive the smaller you got, which was interesting. And so, yeah, you can imagine these things are, you know, like this book, you know, I've got one right here. It, you know, they're evident, you know, blood, sweat, and tears plus $3, $5 a time after 88 times, you know, it's a couple hundred dollars, you know, this thing represents of your life. So it's quite expensive, actually.
Yeah, those books, though, I swear, they're like so, after you're done, it's like you look at it like, I did this. It's such a cool like testament to your trip and travel. And some of them look absolutely astonishing, like the calligraphy on it. Some of them, you could tell some of the office staff were mailing it in on some days. Maybe they're tired or whatever. But then some of them were like really like just so like beautiful. It's the best way to describe it.
I mean, you had mentioned before that somebody, you know, that there's the reasons for doing the pilgrimage are all varied, right?
Yeah.
And one of them is, you know, some people want enlightenment. Some people want to, you know, reach heaven. Some people want to just erase their sins, their Buddhist sins, not the Judeo-Christian sins. But other people are kind of looking to revive their health, right? So there's this idea that actually these are omamori, which are kind of talismans in Japan.
Yeah.
So each of these slips are the Buddha slips, and slips that you give to people with your name on it are considered omamori. So the more times you walk, the more karma that you've created. And so if you walk it 1 to 4 times, you have a white slip, and then, you know, 5 to something, it's a green, and then it's a red, and then it's a, you know, if you walked 100 times, it's a multicolored slip. And this supposedly carries all the weight of your walking and karmic energy, and then is thus supposedly more powerful. So one thing I did, I took one of my slips. So I took a series of my slips, all 88 as a complete set, and I had them mounted into a big frame.
Oh, nice.
And this was on my, I can't remember if it was the first one or the second one. I think it was the first one. And, you know, my dad was going through cancer treatments. And so I just gave it to him as a present. And he hung it up on top of him and my mom's wall above their bed. And I don't know if I played a little part, but cancer treatments were successful,
fully
in remission. And so, you know, people do things like this, right?
Yeah, that's awesome. The Osamu Fuda?
Fuda.
Okay. Like I didn't realize what importance they held. Like I just, like, cause I, at the time, I just didn't understand a lot of the things we were doing. We were just, I read a little bit about it, but I didn't read too deeply into anything. So I just kind of saw them as like meishi for like your like business cards almost for Henro. But we did end up running into somebody that had a gold one. I can't remember if it was a gold 25 or 50.
Gold is one of them. Yeah.
25. Yeah. So apparently this guy gone around a bunch of times. So it's pretty cool to get that. It's in, again, in my little book.
I've got a couple of the multicolored ones.
Oh, do you?
Which are over 100, yeah.
Wow.
So that's one awesome. One or two I met people that had done it and they gave them to me. And then a couple other times, actually, the priest at the temple, they kind of sifted through the ones that were offered at the temple and they kept on to the multicolored ones.
Yeah.
And would give them out to people who came, who were walking.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, that was actually going to bring me to my next question about just the relationship you made with people along the way. Obviously, for myself and Chris, we were hitchhiking. So we got to meet a lot of people in the cars, the people who picked us up. You know, we met people from just in the same area to people who drove down from Sapporo. You know, they drove down and we ended up making friends with a couple who was pregnant, who was doing it, you know, again, for the safe, you know, delivery and health of their baby. Still keep in touch with them a little bit now to this day, which is pretty cool. But for you as a walker, did you run into the same people every day, or were you able to connect with a large variety of people? Because I know we kept seeing the same Henro, especially when we're doing more walking heavy segments, because everyone's making the same trip. So we would see a lot of the same people every day. Did that happen to you a lot as well?
On the first trip, I fell into a group of Henro. So I was about ready to give up at a certain temple, and I was done. And I was kind of sitting outside of a temple. It was raining. I didn't know where I was going to sleep that night. And this guy just walks over to me and says, you want to come with us? A Japanese guy. And desperate, you know, you don't normally just walk away with strangers in normal life, right? But you just go, okay, yeah, sure, I'll come with you. So he brought me to their ryokan that they were staying at, and there was a group of four of them, and they basically taught me how to walk the first time. So if it wasn't for him, you know, teaching me the ropes, how far to walk, what to do, what to think about, how to read my map, like that was like the moment when I kind of figured out how to be a pilgrim. And so I ended up walking with him every day for the rest of the journey. The other two got injured trying to keep up with him, and they basically said, okay, I need to walk slower, so they dropped off. And we basically walked a marathon a day, sometimes more, every single day. And we did the pilgrimage in 29 days, which is way too fast. And my body took a toll. So in that sense, in the first day, the first time I walked it, I met a ton of people, went too fast, really quickly. I was only with that one guy, really intensive relationship. And then the second time was very different. I walked on my own. And so I met other people, and I might have joined them for a day or a half a day. But the thing with walking is everybody walks at a different pace.
Yeah.
So, you know, over a course of a day, you might run to the same people, or 2 days, you might see people. But then very soon after that, you outpace them or they outpace you. And then you start to fall in with a different set of walkers. But then the variety of just normal locals that you meet on Shikoku is amplified by walking, right? You just run into everybody. And there's a practice on Shikoku called Osetai, which is charitable givings, right? So
yeah.
Lots of people are trying to give you things to participate or help you along your journey. And the Osame Fuda come into play there, because if you get Osetai, the rule is you have to accept whatever they give you. And you're supposed to give back the Osame Fuda as an exchange, right? So here's my karma given to you as a slip, the kind of omamori, and I will accept your help. So now you're participating in the walk with me, even as a small. So you get everything from money to food to like little voucher cards. Sometimes people will give you places to stay for free. They'll offer you rides. I got offered tons of beer, which was great sometimes and terrible other times. One time I was lost on some ridgeway somewhere. I was completely off track. I had no water. I had nothing left of me. And I basically had a raw onion and a tomato. And I ate them both like an apple. And they were so delicious. I was so hungry. another time somebody pulled up on a bike, on a motorbike, just coming from their vegetable patch, and gave me a watermelon.
Watermelon?
As a walking pilgrim does not want a watermelon. Okay, so if you're listening, people of Shikoku, slices of watermelon, great. Whole watermelon, really difficult to carry and accept.
Get like a straw and just like jam it in there and just drink.
Yeah, so I cut the top off and I kind of carried it. Just, you know, Japanese watermelons are, you know, to be fair, much smaller than, you know, the American varieties, but. So I just kind of walked with it, like eating it, scooping it out with my hand until I was done. You know, the most memorable ones were always, you know, you're just at that point when you're, you know, you go through these waves of emotion on Shikoku. You're elated one day, like you're on this grand pilgrimage and you're super psyched and you hit this ridgeline path and everything's going great in the world. And then the next thing you know, there's a rain and you don't know where you're going to sleep and you're tired and you're lonely and your feet hurt. And you think that you're like the weakest person in the world. And it's usually at moments like that when somebody just comes by and says, thanks, just thanks for walking, or they just say something nice to you. And it just kind of picks you back up on your feet and gets you going a bit.
Yeah, those low points really do come in waves, I feel like. Especially, I felt like it came with the weather. Like, I was really good on like sunny, you know, maybe not hot sunny days would be different. But when it was like decent weather. But we had, I think, a 2-day stretch on our first, because we had ended up splitting it up over two trips, Haruyasumi and Golden Week. That first leg was 10 days. And we had, I think it was like 2.5 days of straight rain, just torrential downpour. We're walking, we're soaking wet. I had these Doc Martens that I was walking in, which weren't really the greatest walking shoes. And by that trip, they had holes in the bottom of them, and then water was coming in through the holes in the bottom of the shoes. My feet were soaked. My shoes stunk. Like, it was horrible. Like, it was the most miserable 2 days of my life. Maybe not the most miserable, but it was bad. Very low points of that trip, for sure. I remember getting to wherever hotel or ryokan or inn or whatever we found, and I had a hair dryer, and I was just blow drying my shoes just to dry them out. And just this, yeah, it was, and I ended up having to stuff like plastic bags underneath like the soles of my shoes to keep the like a barrier between the water going through to my socks. And then I would actually wrap my feet in plastic bags so that way I could keep my socks and feet dry, because that was the worst feeling, just like trucking through with like nasty wet socks, and you know, and just, it was the worst. And I feel like if you have dry feet, you're in a good mood, but if you don't especially when you're walking around and on your feet a lot, that kind of drives how you're feeling.
Yeah, the blisters and you know, in the book and other things, when you're telling people about Shikoku, I mean, you're constantly thinking about your feet.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's kind of like that thing. Nobody wants to hear about your medical problems, right? Yeah. So you have to, you're kind of have to, you know, you make a note of it to people, but they don't really understand how bad it is until, you know, they go do it themselves. But one great trick that I was taught in Japan by this guy who taught me the first time is after a wet day of walking, you take out the soles of your shoes and you wrap them in newspaper.
Okay.
And then you walk on it and it takes all the moisture out and then you let them dry. And then you take dry newspaper and you shove it into your shoes. And then overnight it wicks in all the moisture. And almost every time I had dry shoes in the morning.
I should have done that instead of plastic bags.
Yeah.
Because plastic bags just kind of kept the moisture in there. Smart. I was working with what I had while I was combining plastic bags. So I wanted to go back to your accommodations. You said that you kind of had some days where you were kind of camping out is the right word. But did you ever stay? I know that some temples offer lodging at their temples themselves. Did you ever stay at a temple, or did you resort mostly to more camping or kind of on your own, figure it out type thing?
Yeah. I think where you stay and how far you go every day is one of those challenges, right? So people who decide to stay in accommodation every night usually book in the morning where they're going to stay, right? Because you want to make sure you have a place to stay. And so then your time of how far you're going to go is dictated by getting to that place where you're going to stay, right? And so it's pretty fixed every time. For me, I was on very little money, right? I mean, I think I had $2,000 each time to do it. And that was for everything, food, accommodation, and, you know, stamps and everything. So you kind of realize really quickly that you can only afford so many rooms. And so what I tried to do was every 6 days to have a room with a shower, generally that I paid for, but keep it to that. So once a week, basically. And then the other days, it was just a mixture. So the map book that was really... The most comprehensive map book that we have is by a Japanese guy named Matsuda-san, and it's great. It has a full mapping of everywhere, all the way down to where the convenience stores are, where you can sleep, paid for and unpaid for accommodation. So, and then I had this list that was given to me at Temple One, which was basically it's a photocopy of a list that somebody started a long time ago and then just kept being added to by people, by walkers. And it's basically a list of where can you stay for free. And it lists near each temple gazebos or bus stops, or there's things called tsuyados, which are free, like a gazebo that lets you to sleep or that has a closed, enclosed area. And then there's zenkonyado, which are usually in people's homes, like a real room where you could sleep. The most famous one was a place called Sakai Taxi, which is no longer in service. But it was basically a taxi station where a guy put a tatami room above his taxi company and then let anybody stay there that wanted to.
Oh, cool.
So I typically did a mix of that. And it was, you know, I would determine how far I wanted to walk that day based on where I thought I was going to sleep. And some days you just couldn't sleep there. And then you had to walk farther and you had to figure it out. It was super stressful. So some days you get to a gazebo and it's full of walking hendro and there's no spot for you to sleep. So you have to continue on. Other places, it's listed as being able to sleep. And then you kind of ask around the town. And sometimes you're unlucky and you find the person and they go, no, you can't stay here. And, you know, it's late at night and you're like, ah. But, you know, on the second time around, I made this decision not to argue with people about stuff, you know, not to try to convince them that if they said no, that was it. You know, they just said no and I'd have to go figure something out. So it's just kind of being flexible.
Yeah.
So I slept in everything. I slept under bridges. I slept in a train station once. I slept in sentos. Oh, great. So there's a couple places where, you know, these super sentos, which are like the public baths, and you can go in there with a ticket to use the bath for as long as you want, but you don't have to leave. So you just sleep on the tatami rooms, you know, come like 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, you just spend the night sleeping there, take another bath and then continue on.
There you go.
I slept on beaches. I slept in people's houses, in some of the temples. I paid for accommodation. Sometimes I slept in a business hotel. It was just super, super varied.
Yeah.
And just dictated by how far I could get that day.
Nice. And so we had mentioned briefly earlier that Shikoku is just, you know, has all types of nature, scenery and everything. What was one of the most beautiful places that you saw on that trip?
Ooh, it's in the book. This is one place on Shikoku that I love. It's a path just above Temple 45. And you only get to it if you're a walker. And you only get to it if you ignore the fastest way to get to the temple. So you have to come around from the backside of Temple 45. And you hit, which I can only describe as the most perfect path in the world. You know, it's like this ridgeline path with these trees perfectly shaded just over you. Kind of straight, meandering. And then it drops down into the backside of the temple, which is already a fantastic temple built into the side of rock-faced cliffs. But the back part of it is the okunuin, which is kind of the inner sanctuary of each temple.
Yeah.
Right? And typically it's separated from where the temple is. And, you know, you have to kind of go on a hike to get there. And it's just these massive cypress trees, old growth forest, moss-covered rocks, ancient like statues. I mean, you just brought back into this like beautiful, perfect nature into this primordial temple setting. And yeah, it's like my happy place every time. I just think of like, what's the most perfect place in the world? It's that.
That's so cool.
That one place.
Yeah. And did you have any other temples that really stick out in your memory as like unique?
I mean, definitely Temple 45. They're all a bit unique. I mean, they're all a bit unique.
Yeah. But, they're all different.
You know, they're all different and varied. And they're based on like the town that they're in.
Yeah.
Temple 12, Shosanji, which is, you know, after your very first kind of right out of Tokushima, it's kind of like your biggest hike through the woods. It's a long day of climbing. Again, it's on top of a mountain. It's in these beautiful trees. Basically, any of them are on top of mountains are just like incredibly beautiful. There's another one that really stood out. It's in the book as well, is I can't remember the number of it now, but if you read the book, you'll find it. I was just passing through and one of the guys there was like, hey, you want to stay here with me? I was like, you know, what do you mean? Do you want to stay with me here and help me out? And so I stayed for a few days and another pilgrim had been staying for a year. And basically the obosan, the monk was building a traditional hand forge for swords, a pottery area, a traditional ofuro, and he wanted to build he had this carpenter there, who's the guy who asked me to stay, a traditional kind of temple carpenter who was basically just living there for years with nothing but room and board building things.
Huh.
And so he would just ask people to stay and help him out. So I spent 3 days kind of just loving, you know, food was provided and we just did construction all day long.
That's cool.
It was fun.
I'm trying to think back to like the different temples that they had. I think it was like 62 Unpenji? Where they have all like the statues.
Yep.
The big statues with all the different faces. I thought that was like so, so cool. And like just unique. I hadn't seen anything like that along the trip. I know they had a few of them had like little Jizo statues. Like one of them had a lot kind of along the trail. I can't remember which one that is. But the Unpenji always sticks out in my mind as just because you have to take unless you hike. They have like a rope gondola. Mm-hmm. To get up there, which is really cool. And then there was one that was like kind of like a sci-fi movie, like one of those, it's like very modern. It was in the 40s, I think. I can't remember the number. But yeah, that one also sticks out in my mind because it was just so, it looked like a giant
concrete block.
Yeah. Giant concrete block instead of your traditional temple looking building.
Yeah, it was built more on the kind of church kind of convention center style thing. So Unpenji, just before that, I guess there's one other that stood out in my mind is the Beikaku. There's one just before Unpenji that if you're walking, you'll get to it. It's in the book as well. I guess just to say, you know, Japan also has a lot of fertility shrines. And let's just say, this temple had a lot of fertility signs, statues in it.
There you go. Hot travel tip for Shikoku if you want to see those.
That's right. If you want to, you know.
So when you did your first trip and you made it to Temple 88, you know, you're like, I'm done. I did it. I made my way through it. Then you found out that you had to get back to Temple 1 to complete the circle.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, there's one more. There's Temple 89, which is actually 1. How did you feel? Like, were you like, was there a sense of relief? And then you're like, oh, crap. You got to go a little bit further back.
So the first time I was walking with this guy, Matsushita. So I knew we had planned to go back to Temple 1.
Oh, okay.
So, and that was a big day. I think we walked something like 55 miles that day. It was terrible. So we walked straight from the morning all the way until something like 4 o'clock in the morning because he wanted to do one last big grinding push after, you know, a marathon a day.
Yeah.
So in my mind, it was always go back to Temple 1. And then after that, you're supposed to go to Koya-san, which is in Wakayama.
Koya-san, yeah.
To report back to Kobodaishi on what you'd experienced. But it was really interesting. The second time I walked, I ended the last day. There's a couple of people that I did meet. I said I'd meet the same people. There was one or two people that I did end up meeting a couple of different times. And towards the end, I ended up walking with this guy the last few days together. And we got to Temple 88, and he's like, okay, I'm done. I'm taking a taxi home. And I was like, what are you talking about? You know, you got to get back to Temple 1. I was like, no, that's not a thing. He's Japanese. He goes, that's not a thing at all. I'm like, I think it's a thing. And so we were kind of going back and forth. And I said, well, anyway, I'm going to walk back to Temple 1. And it's really clearly the Obo-san who was signing my book got really upset with me. And he's like, you're so stupid, you know, baka, and just starts yelling at me. And I'm like, huh? And he goes, 88, it's an 88 temple. It's not an 89 temple pilgrimage. It's an 88 temple pilgrimage. What are you, stupid? You know, and I'm just like, what a way to end your pilgrimage with the monk screaming at you, telling you that you're stupid. And, you know, we had a chat about it. And, you know, from his perspective, he's 88. He's it. You know, you start at number one and you end at 88.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people, you want to complete the loop, so you go back to one. And so
that's,
I think
what
there's a bit of a mix, right? Well, yeah. There's a turns out, just like everything on Shikoku, it depends, and there's a difference in opinion on what exactly you're supposed to do.
Oh my goodness, yeah, that's funny though. Imagine you're like feeling the sense of accomplishment, like, I just made it through here, and then you're getting like bombarded with like insults from a monk.
Yeah, you kind of want to be like embraced and welcomed, like, great job. Instead, you're just like, idiot.
Well, I was going to ask you, what's your one unique That's So Japan experience from the two, you know, from either of your two pilgrimages, but not that wouldn't really be a That's So Japan experience, though. That would be more of a, wow, I didn't see that coming.
Well, I guess if you read the book, you know, some of the teaser to the book, right, is I get accosted by Yakuza in a bath, in a public bath. I have an interesting experience at a yakitori bar, which can only happen in Japan. I met scam artist pilgrims. I met super sweet people. So maybe it just goes back to the question of, you know, only in Japan. You asked about, you know, what are the different types of people that I met? And I'd say the book is really about who did I meet, right? So
yeah.
When I wrote the book, I thought it was going to be about me, right? So I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do in life and who I was going to become. That's still in there kind of as a baseline kind of personal growth thing. But what became more of an interesting question to me was, what do I think Japan is? And Japan is not homogeneous. It's not, everybody has this kind of idealized version of Japan. And it can be too easy to romanticize a Japanese Buddhist pilgrimage. So I didn't want to fall into that trap either.
Sure.
So, you know, what I tried to do is just show from my perspective, what are all the different facets of Japan that are unique and different and contradictory? I think that's what Japan is. It's really contradictory. And it's shown by all the different people I met. So I met and talked to, right? So I'm fluent in Japanese. So when I had time, I would just sit, talk or walk with people. And I think each of their stories, even if I met with them just briefly or had a little bit longer with them, ends up telling a piece of what is modern day Japan by the people going to Shikoku. So it's some people looking to get some respite or just be on vacation. It's some people who are forced out of Japanese normal society. So I met a lot of homeless people that had taken up becoming pilgrims just because they had no place else to fit in, but they were at least accepted on the pilgrimage. And then you have other people that just... we're trying to figure out what they want to do next in life. And they didn't know what they wanted to do. And so all of them have like a little story, and almost none of them fit into the stereotypical image of, you know, a typical Japanese person that we kind of form our boxes around.
That's awesome. I wish I had read more of your book prior to the interview. Unfortunately, it's like we were talking about this before we started, just time restraints in terms of being a parent, just kind of, if I could stay awake to read more than a couple of pages, it's not because of your book. It's because my eyes just can't stay open more than I can. But I had one more question for you before we wrap everything up. Shikoku itself, you know, the pilgrimage, I feel like is the primary source of, I don't want to say tourism, but visitors coming to Shikoku. I would say that's probably like the number one reason most people go there. I'm sure there are other people that go for surfing along the, you know, the Pacific coast, or, you know, some people go to Matsuyama, you know, Dogo Onsen and all that stuff. Tokushima has big festivals in the summer. But did you have any opportunities to take part in any non-pilgrimage related travel or exploration on the island of Shikoku while you were there?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you're really focused on the pilgrimage, it's pilgrimage. But, you know, Shikoku's got a lot going for it. It's beautiful food, great sake, amazing nature, lots of really great rafting and hiking and mountain areas in the middle of Shikoku. For me, all of my trips on Shikoku were focused on walking. So I was kind of limited to what I was doing then. But I've been to Shikoku a bunch of other times for other things. So I used to do a lot of Aikido, especially when I was in Japan. So we'd go to our, you know, friends' dojos in Ehime. And, you know, there's the classic Dogo Onsen that's there, that's kind of featured in the book Bonchan. Then there's the Ia Valley, which is like right in the middle of Shikoku, which was a place where kind of old armies would go and retreat to because it was so remote, one of the most remote areas in the country. Alex Kerr's book, kind of Lost Japan, and his project there called the Chiori Project, which is renovating an old kominka, and so an old farmhouse, and then providing people places, you know, to be able to stay at that, to keep it revitalized. And now he's taken over, or his group has taken over, lots of different kominka around that area that you can go
I've heard
stay
about
at.
That. It's super interesting and a great way to give back and kind of revitalize communities over there.
That's right. And then there's the other town just south of Tokushima City that is nothing but, it's a zero waste village. So everything in the village is recycled or reused. And so it's just a super cool place to go visit. And they got a brewery there doing craft brew. And, you know, Shikoku just has these really cool pockets of hip culture that I think are coming up. It's still probably the least visited place overall in Japan, but it's just an awesome place. I mean, pilgrimage aside, I plan just to go back and cycle, hike, visit friends, do different things there.
Yeah, usually when we travel to Japan, it's to visit family, and we end up staying in more in the Kanto area, Kanto Lower Tohoku. So we don't really get to travel to that side of the country too often because again, short trips. So gotta, I guess, keep efficient where we can. But I would love to. I can't wait to go back one day and do that. Hopefully, do the pilgrimage again. I was telling you before the interview too. I plan to force my child to go with me when he comes of age to do it, you know, as a father-son bonding experience. So I would love to go back, whether it's to hitchhike or walk or drive or whatever, but just to go through that, even if it's portions, you know, the different ways of doing it, I think it'd be really cool. But yeah, that's been great. I don't get to talk about Shikoku much. I don't know a lot of people who've been to Shikoku. So it's like, when I find someone I can talk to it about, I just kind of geek out a little bit. But I don't want to keep you too much longer. I know you had some other things going on. But I did want to conclude with an opportunity for you to pitch anything else you may be working on, or maybe mention where people can find your book online, or anything else you want to share.
Yeah, thanks. No, it's been really great. I mean, I'm never going to pass up an opportunity to talk about Shikoku. It's one of those formative things in my life that I really love. I keep going back to. Where you can find me, toddwassell.com. I blog there sometimes, add stories, but the main thing is the book. If you're interested in Shikoku, you're interested in Japan, I'd really appreciate it if you pick up a copy. You can buy it on Amazon. It's probably the easiest place, either in ebook or in printed copy. And if you do like it, leave a review, give a copy to a friend, whatever you want to do. But it's been a interesting secondary journey besides the actual walking one to then write about Shikoku. It's been fun. And I have two more books planned in the series that actually take me out of Shikoku. So Shikoku was largely, what is Japan and what do I want to do with life? I figured it out. I won't tell you what it was, what I want to do with life. And then the next two books in the series is how do you actually live that life that you dreamed up on the top of a mountain in Shikoku.
Oh, cool. I can't wait. I will definitely make sure to put a link to your website and a link to the Amazon page where we can, you know, people can look and purchase your book. Great. Make sure we can make it accessible for them. Because again, I'm hoping to, on the plane, be able to knock out a chunk of your book. If not, when I'm being shuttled around in the back of a minivan, in Japan with a couple kids. Maybe I can read a few pages here and there too. But I would love. Well, I can't wait.
No promises this year, but I am hoping to actually record an audio version of it too.
Oh, all right. Now that would be easier. I could put that on while I'm walking or running. So. All right, man. Well, thank you so much for joining. It was so much fun. I know our listeners are going to love this. And have a safe trip back to the U.S. and to Japan. And I hope you have fun.
Yeah, great. It's going to be good to finally get back to Japan.
Oh, I bet.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
And that's it for this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in to the Crew of Japan podcast. I want to give a huge shout out and thank you to Todd Wessel for coming on to discuss Shikoku and the 88 Temple Pilgrimage with us. If you enjoy what you listened to today, check out Todd's book, Walking in Circles. We'll have a link in the show notes. Or check out Todd's website, TODDWASSEL.com. That link will also be in the show notes. Man, just talking about it brought back a flood of vivid memories for me. Such wonderful times, even the ones where I was plastic bagging my rain-soaked Doc Martens and was pretty miserable. But even then, it was such a great time looking back. So hopefully today's episode introduced you to something different and perhaps even piqued your interest in checking out Shikoku and some of the temples of the pilgrimage. Remember, you don't have to do them all at once. Just do what you can, however you can do it. Have you ever been to Shikoku, or have you done a temple pilgrimage in Japan? Share with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok at Crew of Japan Podcast. At KREWEOFJAPAN, that's Twitter. At KREWEOFJAPANPODCAST, that's Instagram and TikTok. And just search us on Facebook, Crew of Japan Podcast. While you're there, give us a follow, like, retweet, share, or whatever else. Drop us a comment. Let us know how you're enjoying the podcast. Or perhaps, maybe you prefer to provide feedback in a more private setting. Send us an email at crewofjapanpodcast@gmail.com. Speaking of feedback, if you're enjoying what you're listening to right now, or maybe last week, or the week before, or this whole season, or all of our seasons, please feel free to leave us a 5-star review on your favorite podcast streaming app. We're still trying to level up that rating game, y'all, and I'm going to say it every week. But seriously, any and all support is greatly appreciated. We really enjoy doing this and really enjoy spending time with you guys on these Friday podcasts. Also, don't forget, October 8th, that's a Saturday, Japan Fest is taking place at New Orleans Museum of Art. Come stop by the Japan Society New Orleans table. We'll be there. And if you can't make it there, come out on October 12th at 6:30 p.m. to the Stone Auditorium in Waldenburg Arts Center on Tulane University's campus. In partnership with Tulane Asian Studies Program and JETA Mid-South, the local JET alumni chapter, Japan Society New Orleans is hosting a discussion on all things Godzilla featuring Dr. William Tsutsui, with funding provided by National Association of Japan American Societies. We'd love to see you there. So that's it for today. Until next time.